You're listening to Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. It is Friday. Happy Friday, everybody. But it also means, since it's Friday, it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on news that made headlines around our region this week. A lot to get to today. And our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Kelsey Mosley Morris with Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com, is joining us just for this first segment to get us updated on a big case out of East Idaho. So happy Friday, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hello.
Hey. So, Nate, as I mentioned, I want to begin with the very latest in the Daybell case. This is Lori and Chad Daybell. They are accused of murder as well as other charges in the deaths of two of Lori's children. So Nate, they were in court yesterday. Get us up to date on what happened.
Okay. Yeah. We're getting really close to the trial. It's coming up on April 3rd. And so a lot of what happened in court yesterday had to deal with that upcoming trial. And there were some big decisions made. It was about a three-hour hearing. The first big decision was that the defense attorneys for both Chad and Lori had made a motion for Chad and Lori to meet in person for strategy sessions or to formulate some sort of a settlement agreement. And that was something that they said they would need in order to maybe possibly mediate this case. But the prosecution had a big problem with that. They said that if you got Chad and Lori in a room with their attorneys, there would be some attorney-client privilege issues, and there'd possibly be some major pitfalls. The judge agreed and ultimately said that Chad and Lori couldn't meet together, that would be a really bad idea. So if there is going to be a settlement, it's going to come in another form. The second thing that happened at this hearing was talk about sequestering a jury. Prosecutors are very concerned. This is a very high-profile case. There's been tons of publicity. They're very worried about the jury having outside contact, seeing other news reports about this, essentially discussing the case. And so the prosecutor said, let's sequester them, keep them away from everyone for a full 10 weeks, which is the expected length of the trial. The defense had a big problem with that because mostly because of the length of the trial. A 10-week trial is a very long period of time to sequester a jury. And the defense worried that if jurors had to be sequestered for that long, it would severely limit the pool of people they could have in a jury. Ultimately, the judge agreed. He says that there are other ways that they can keep jurors secure, and he says there's no need to keep them prisoner for 2 months. So there will be no sequestering of the jury at this time.
Okay.
The last major thing that was discussed was Chad Daybell's attorney, John Pryor, wanted to delay the trial for another year. As he said, that there's still DNA evidence he hasn't gotten from the state. And he says that if he doesn't get it from the state and he doesn't have a chance to test it, that Chad may raise some issues with the trial on appeal. The problem here is that Lori has not waived her right to a speedy trial. So the judge's hands are a little tied because Chad and Lori's cases are connected. You have Chad who's wanting to extend the trial out a year, and you have Lori that's wanting to go and do it right now. So at the moment, the judge is saying, because Lori hasn't waived her right to a speedy trial, we're going to go ahead with it. We have to go ahead with it in April. But he did say that if John Pryor does not get the DNA evidence from the state, he may consider separating the cases between Chad and Lori so there would be two trials. But at the moment, they're still joined and we're still planning to have a trial in April.
All right. So this trial starting in April, April 3rd, as you said, in Ada County.
Yes.
And okay. And I was looking at when you said it there, and they're setting aside 10 weeks for this. So I thought the issue of sequestering the jury was interesting, Nate, and the judge's response to that, because we're looking at mid-June for this trial to potentially wrap up. That's just the trial itself, right? That's not deliberations by the jury or anything like that. So you would definitely, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, parents of young children, right? You're thinking of people who can't take that amount of time off of work without losing their job. So, right. So what was the reaction from prosecutors in court then when the judge said, no, we're not sequestering the jury?
You know, they were disappointed. I think they've really wanted sequestration to happen, but I also think they understood where the judge is coming from. I'm not sure they thought they were going to win, but they're understandably disappointed.
Yeah. So as of right now, April 3rd is the start date. I know that you will have a reporter from East Idaho News covering this the entire time. I mean, your outlet has been following this case since the very, very beginning. So we will look to you for updates. So I appreciate your time today, Nate.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely. So before we move on, I do also quickly, Kevin, want to talk about another high-profile case, this of the University of Idaho homicide, the four homicides that happened, because a judge in Latah County, extended the gag order, Kevin, yesterday?
Yes, just really quickly, and this was reported by the Idaho Statesman. The gag order that was issued recently, judge has extended now to not only include the prosecutors and the defense attorneys, investigators and law enforcement personnel, it now extends to attorneys representing the victims. So what was already a fairly broad gag order was made even more broad. And it's worth noting that a number of news media outlets around the state, including Idaho Education News, are party to a potential appeal. We're looking at our legal options regarding the gag order.
Mm-hmm. And we should note that Boise State Public Radio is a part of that as well. Mm-hmm. Moving on, let's look at what's going on at the State House. And Kelsey, there has been much discussion this week in regards to abortion. And there is now a Senate committee. They're advancing a bill that would change the legal definition of abortion. Can you talk to us about this?
Yeah, this happened on Monday. Senator Scott Herndon, who's from Sagal, which is around Sandpoint in North Idaho, brought forward two bills. One was about removing the exceptions for rape and incest from the current abortion ban. And that one did not advance. That was returned to the sponsors. So that was kind of expected, but that it might come back in another form. There's also the one that did advance is changing the definition to the intentional killing of a living human embryo or fetus in utero instead of just the intentional termination of a pregnancy, because there have been a lot of concerns from medical professionals who say, you know, that definition is too broad. That does not give them enough clarity as far as ectopic pregnancies, because if there's a embryo that has a heartbeat, but it's ectopic and it's not viable, they didn't know what to do. To be clear, an ectopic pregnancy is when the embryo implants in the fallopian tube or somewhere else outside of the uterus, and they are not viable pregnancies. So this is intended to make that clearer and to make that distinction. A lot of the rhetoric that they talk about around it is this takes away a talking point from left-leaning people who oppose the ban and want to say that it's intended to help or to make pregnant women die in medical emergencies. So this is kind of intended to fix that talking point. We'll see where it goes. He said that he had run it past some OBGYNs and some pro-life groups, and they were happy with language and said it added some clarity to the law. So it's actually closer to the definitions that existed in the late 1800s when most of the states had abortion laws on the books for the first time. So this is kind of a callback to those days, interestingly.
Yeah. So Kelsey, what is next then in this process?
So it started off in the Senate. So they haven't had a full hearing on that yet. That should be coming next week, I would guess. And then from there, it would go to the full Senate and then over to the House side. I don't know what to expect as far as what abortion legislation might be coming from the House side. So it's going to be interesting to see if there are any competing bills or, things of similar nature and how those might conflict.
Okay. So, Kevin, let's talk school choice. This is a big issue at the State House this session. So first, for folks who may not be following this closely or maybe they don't quite understand what school choice is, can you talk a little bit about what school choice is? And then let's dig in to how this idea is really starting to show some divisions within the Republican Party.
Yeah, let's cut past the terminology and the jargon, because both sides are using jargon to their advantage.
Yeah.
What we're really talking about here legislatively comes down to a very simple question. You have public dollars that are allocated for K-12 education. Do you want any of those public dollars to move into programs that parents could use for private education, for religious education? That's the issue. And whether you want to call it school choice, as certainly the supporters like to call it, if you want to call it a voucher system, as the opponents like to call it, that's really the essence of the question. And it's really going to be, I would say, the most divisive education question that we're going to see at the 2023 legislature. We're already seeing that. We're already seeing signs of how it's dividing Republicans at the State House. And as I wrote this week, I think it's become a proxy fight for larger issues within the Republican Party. You have Republicans, starting with Governor Brad Little, who are very skeptical about the idea of diverting public dollars into private education. He's been pretty clear that he wants to invest in public education and put more money into the public education system. Where you have more conservative members of the Republican Party, including the chairwoman of the Idaho GOP, Dorothy Moon, pushing for a diversion of public dollars into private education. The fight at the State House is just beginning, but it's already a fight that's dividing the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Kevin, it's worth noting, I think, too, that there are other states, Arizona to be exact, who have done this kind of school voucher system. And, what they're finding, like in a state like Arizona, is that, this idea is parents are getting this money. So whether your child goes to public school or private school, and that money isn't necessarily going back into public schools, and people who already had their kids in private schools are now just using that money to pay tuition. So, and I know that this is a talking point of like, well, Arizona's doing it, we can do this here in Idaho. I think on the other hand, you can say, aren't there groups that really want to, take that funding away from public schools so that people, kids can go to private schools, and frankly, you don't have to pay for it.
I think you have folks across the spectrum on this, and you're definitely right, Gemma. I mean, there are folks, the Idaho Freedom Foundation being maybe at the forefront of this, who have made no bones about the fact that they do not, they want to see funding moved away from public schools. They prefer to call them government schools. I think that's definitely a part of a part of their push. And I think there are other folks who are saying we'd like to expand the options that parents have, not necessarily get rid of public education per se, which is hard to do. It's constitutionally mandated that mm-hmm. Idaho create a common public free system of public education. So you can't exactly get rid of public schools in Idaho unless you want to change the Constitution, and good luck with that. So you have folks who definitely see this as a method of defunding public education, where you also have folks who are saying, well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to defund, but we do want to see if there's a way to accommodate a little bit of both. And that's where you get State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield, who has really been trying to walk an extremely fine line on this issue, to the point of really sending mixed signals about where exactly she stands on all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it does put her in this interesting situation, Kevin, right? Because here she has been elected to be the superintendent of public schools and to make sure that public schools are running well, are being funded, right? Kids are being educated.
Right. I mean, it's in the job description. You're the superintendent of public instruction. So by nature, you're supposed to be an advocate for the public education system. And that's where it gets complicated for her, and where it got complicated for her this week at the State House. She was asked in both the House and Senate Education Committees about her position on education savings accounts. And in the Senate, she was pretty blunt about it. She said, I am not in the position where I'm going to be an advocate for moving public dollars into private education, which sounds like, you know, that's case closed as far as where she stands on this issue. But really, it isn't, because I asked her to kind of elaborate on that some this week, and I got a mm-hmm. statement from Critchfield's staff saying that she's open to expanding the Empowering Parents Family Education Grant Program to provide the option of using some of that money for private school tuition. But that's public dollars. The Empowering Parents Program right now is federally funded. Governor Little wants to make it a state-funded initiative. Those are public dollars. Those dollars are not, you know, coming from a money tree somewhere. They are coming from taxpayers.
Right. And so, Kevin, I guess, I mean, this is not the last we're going to hear of this. I think this is going to be a huge issue this session, right? But I mean, you're talking public.
Just getting underway.
Right. And you're talking public dollars. You're talking public tax dollars. And diverting those, basically allowing parents to decide, well, do I want to put them in do I put kids in public school? Do I want to homeschool, private school? You know, giving parents this choice, I guess. Yet at the same time, I mean, isn't there going to be potentially an issue with the fact that, as you said, these are public dollars? We, in our Constitution, we have to educate children in the public school system. If you want your child to go to private school, you have that option already. You have to pay for it, but you have that option.
And I think that's the argument that opponents of making this move will make. There's nothing that prevents a parent from making that choice of putting their children in a private school or parochial school. You can do that, and those schools are around. And I guess that also gets to a question that we'll hear a lot about in the coming weeks: is there equality of opportunity around the state? I mean, there are quite a few private schools, parochial schools in Boise, not as many options like that in rural Idaho. So that becomes a part of the equation as well. But yeah, fundamentally, you're right. I mean, parents can put their kids in any kind of school that they want. That's been, you know, pretty well established in, you know, in state law and state policy for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, another big issue, and let's talk about money, is Medicaid spending. So this is going to potentially be a big issue for legislators on the Budget Committee. Can you explain first, you know, a little bit of background on this and why we are where we are in regards to Medicaid spending or limiting Medicaid spending?
Yeah, the Medicaid budget, I think, has the potential to be a real choke point this year. This week, the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee heard from the Department of Health and Welfare and their budget request for fiscal year 2024. And Medicaid is a big chunk of that. And it has grown precipitously particularly since voters approved Medicaid expansion in 2018. And then that took effect in January of 2020. And so the budget request for this year is $4.6 billion for Medicaid alone. That's a 16% increase from the current year, which was a 6.5% increase from the previous year. So it is growing precipitously. And the members of the Budget Committee, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, really asked some pointed questions about spending and how to limit spending. And Idaho Department of Health and Welfare Director Dave Jepson did his best, his level best, to try to answer those questions. A lot of the answers were simply, healthcare is really expensive. Prescription costs are really expensive. And healthcare, in-home healthcare, is really expensive. And he talked about expansion, the expansion part of it. And if you'll notice, that expansion took place in January of 2020. About 2 months later, we hit the global pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. And that ended up putting a bunch of people, like tens of thousands of people, on the Medicaid rolls who may not necessarily be eligible for Medicaid any longer. However, the federal government said you can't kick anybody off of Medicaid during the health emergency. So we've gone the past 2 years without kicking anybody off, but that chicken is coming home to roost. That starting in February, the Department of Health and Welfare is going to be culling that list of people who are Medicaid recipients. We've got about 450,000 Idahoans on Medicaid right now. And the state has determined that there may be as many as 150,000 of those that may no longer be eligible. So almost a third might be ineligible. And they're going to spend the next few months, starting in February, notifying those folks and trying to get some of those folks off of the Medicaid rolls. So that it still remains that healthcare costs are astronomical. And I think what we're going to see, JFAC still needs to approve this budget. I think that the legislators, there are a lot of legislators like Senator Kevin Cook and Representative Rod Furness, who are really asking good questions and delving in deep into the numbers and understand the nuance and the complexities of the budget. There are some who are just kind of taking the stance that, well, this is just a bunch of lazy people sitting in front of a TV and eating junk food, and we shouldn't be helping these folks. But I think are there going to be enough on JFAC, on the JFAC committee, who are not ideologues and want to solve the problem of controlling costs? Because Medicaid, again, is supposed to be helping those most in need. And if you can't control costs, then you're arguably not helping those who need it most. So that budget hearing, I think, is going to be one of the most interesting ones to watch in JFACs.
Well, and Scott, just so I'm understanding this correctly, because Medicaid expansion did pass through a ballot initiative, I mean, the legislators do have to fund Medicaid or not?
Well, they could. They do have to. Yes, they could. Yes, they have to. They have to fund Medicaid. It's they could take action against the Medicaid expansion part of it. That voters approved in 2018, and there have been people who have said that we should repeal it. And I'm not sure if the discussions in JFAC really point to that option. I think that people recognize that expansion kind of coincided with the pandemic, and there's a little bit of a, well, let's see if we can get some of these folks off of Medicaid who are not necessarily eligible before we throw the baby out with the bathwater on Medicaid expansion.
Okay, that makes sense. I appreciate that. So, Kevin, we have talked a lot on this program about teacher pay here in Idaho. We also know it's a priority for the governor during this latest legislative session. And one of your colleagues recently wrote a really interesting article explaining that when it comes to teacher pay, location matters.
Yeah, it certainly does. And this is something we've done before, but it was really important, I think, to do it now as we head into a legislative session where we're going to be talking about teacher pay. What Carly Flandra did for this story is she looked at the districts that have the highest teacher pay on average and the lowest teacher pay on average. And I don't know if really the highest salaries are going to be terribly surprising to you. The top three are Blaine County, McCall Donnelly, and Boise. Now, those are three districts that have a lot of competitive pressure to increase teacher pay. And what you also see in Boise, and we've talked about this many times, is that Boise has a tax levy base that other school districts simply don't have, which allows them to put more money into teacher salaries and recruit and retain teachers. I mean, it's been an ongoing issue of teachers, leaving districts around Boise to take a job in Boise because they can get higher pay. Down on the lower end of the scale, the lowest average salary, you would have to strain to find this district. It is the Prairie Elementary School District. It's way out there in the boonies. Has the lowest average teacher salary, but location matters. Experience matters too, because the way the salary structure is designed, districts that have a more experienced teacher workforce, that's going to factor into what they have available and what they have to spend on teacher salaries. But interesting numbers, especially as we're going to have a lot of discussion about trying to increase teacher pay and increase starting teacher pay.
Yeah, I thought it was as well. So Scott, an Idaho lawmaker, has basically told anybody who is under the age of 18, he doesn't want to hear from them. In fact, what, they can't testify at any hearings this session?
Unless they're invited. So this
Oh,
comes from our
right.
good friends at Boise Weekly. Gene Huff broke this story this week that Idaho Representative Bruce Skaug, Republican of Nampa, he is the chairman of the Judiciary House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee. And he said he won't allow testimony from anyone under 18 years old unless he invites them. And his reasoning was really quite stunning, I think. He said that large groups of teenagers testifying, quote, prevents adults and taxpayers from being able to testify. We have 16-year-olds taking the place of 40-year-olds. I just want some control to be able to get the testimony of all the adults, taxpayers in the room. I think he's kind of forgetting that teenagers are also taxpayers. Those who have jobs pay income tax, and those who buy things pay sales tax. And then also, it just kind of, it's an odd thing to say, to consider children, people under 18 years old to not be citizens, that these are, they're still citizens. And some of these bills that come before the legislature are definitely going to affect students. And shouldn't they have a seat at the table rather than at the whim of the chairman? Now, I can understand that chairs, committee chairs have discretion and can set parameters and rules. And, if you've got people repeating the same message over and over again, you can limit that kind of testimony. But to kind of put this blanket age-based ban on testimony unless he gives the say-so really smacks of age discrimination and, really taxation without representation.
Oh,
Can I
100%. And I think it tends to go back to the fact that we have seen in the last couple of sessions teenagers coming in trying to testify. Sometimes they get the opportunity, sometimes they don't. And to say that, well, if you don't matter if you're under the age of 18 goes exactly to what you said, Scott. There's no representation in that.
Yeah, and it's also, it's something that I've kind of suspected for a long time, that a lot of these committee hearings, they're really not listening to the people who testify. They're only listening to the people that they want to listen to. And so this kind of suggests or illustrates that general attitude of like, look, I don't care what you have to say, so I'm not even going to let you testify. So just, hopefully some of the more reasonable people in the room will have a talk with Representative Skaug and say, maybe you should rethink this policy. But we'll see. We'll see if there's something that comes up before his committee that he does put a kibosh on younger people testifying, and what are the parameters that he sets around that, and see if he actually can listen to the people who want to speak before the committee.
And Kelsey, did you want to jump in here?
I was just going to say there's a bill on Monday in the Senate House or the Senate Judiciary and Rules Committee about marriage and getting rid of marriage licenses. And in Idaho, you can get married at 16 if you have permission. And so if that goes over to the House Judiciary and Rules Committee, people who will be affected by that change as well would not be allowed to testify. So it's just an interesting rule to have in place.
Well, and it even goes back to what, you know, we were talking about earlier in regards to school choice, right? I mean, who's impacted the most by school choice? Mm. It's kids. Most of these kids who are in school are under the age of 18. So to not hear from people who are going to be the most impacted by things just seems, frankly, quite unfair. Kelsey, I want to talk about another Senate bill. And this, this is House Bill 2. Now, this would punish cities and maybe city leaders who don't abide by the state's abortion law. A, can you explain this? And then where are we in terms of this bill?
So this is also brought to us by Representative Skog from Nampa. It's pretty much aimed at Boise because they're the only city that has passed a resolution stating that they would limit city resources from being used to take legal action against someone for seeking or performing an abortion. They passed that resolution in July, shortly after Roe v. Wade was overturned. And it is a punitive bill. It's meant to threaten the sales tax revenue distribution to a city if they have a resolution like this, and they have, I think, 180 days to repeal or rescind the order. Otherwise, their distribution would be held back. And in Boise's case, in 2022, that would be $6.7 million. So that's a pretty hefty chunk of change. And it didn't get a whole lot of testimony on, I think it was Wednesday, that they had a hearing on it. There was just some back and forth from pro-life groups who said, you know, you should follow the laws that we have on the books. You shouldn't be allowed to decide you're not going to follow the law. And there was, I think, one person who said, you know, you should let people in city official capacity do what's best for their constituents and what their constituents want. So it is broadly termed in the legislation, but it's definitely aimed at the one city that has done that. And Representative Skog and also the Idaho Family Policy Center's president, Wayne Kanzati, both called it anarchy to allow this to stand. And so it passed the House committee. I'm not sure if they've had a vote on the floor yet, but that would still need to go over to the Senate side and have a hearing in the State Affairs Committee.
Okay, so that's where we are with this bill, waiting just to see that next step. Okay. Kevin, so we have school safety tip lines in our state, and calls really went up in 2022. So I'm curious about your takeaway on this, but first, kind of explain what a school safety tip line is for folks who may not be aware that we have these.
And I think that's the important thing to note here. The state has established a new tip line. It's relatively new. It's been in existence since 2019. And the idea is that it allows students mainly, but anybody who has a school safety concern to report that. And they can report that over a smartphone app. They can phone it in. They can go on the website. There are a lot of different ways to get a tip to the proper authorities. The head of the state's school and safety program was before the legislative committees, legislative education committees on Thursday, and he reported that the numbers of tips going into that tip line have skyrocketed. You had over 300 reports last year. By comparison, in the first year we had 64 reports, so it's climbed fairly rapidly, including the past year. And that sounds bad. That sounds like we've got a mounting problem in the schools. That may not necessarily be the case, because he thinks that it's a sign of people are becoming more aware that they have a tip line, that they have a confidential line that they can phone possible problems into. It's also, he says, reaching out into rural districts that didn't have tip lines in place beforehand. Larger districts might have had their own programs in place for several years before 2019 and this new state program. So this is reaching into communities that might not have otherwise had had a place, had a resource where people could call. And maybe the most important thing of all here, the most important number of all here, is they said they've received 9 critical reports. And what that means, what critical means, is a student who is at immediate risk to themselves or to others. Those are calls that are coming in. And what Mike Munger, the head of the School Safety and Security Program, is telling lawmakers, this is a program that's saving lives.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because at first, Kevin, as you say, I mean, it seems kind of shocking that, oh my gosh, it went up this much. But at the same time, thank goodness we have a tip line like this and that it is anonymous. And so that people can use this, as you said, to potentially save lives.
Right. I mean, if you strictly look at the bar chart, and I've got it in my computer in front of me, threefold increase in calls from 2021 to 2022. And you look at that numbers and you're like, oh my goodness, what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is students especially feel like they have a place where they can report things and maybe head off, catastrophic, disastrous, tragic circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So Kelsey, let's head back to the legislature one more time before we wrap things up today, because there is another Senate bill that you've reported on. And this would not require gender considerations when it comes to public work contracts, but these could only be with state funding, correct? Because if you're federally funded, you have to follow these guidelines.
It's a little bit wonky, isn't it?
it is.
So basically the backstory is the Civil Rights Act, it was passed in the 60s, and there was an executive order sometime in the 70s or 80s that kind of amended that to say these non-discrimination ordinances should apply to federal contracting laws. And that included, race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. And then in 2014, former President Barack Obama, he amended that order to sexual orientation and gender identity as factors that you couldn't discriminate against when you're in federal contracting. That has not been changed since then, to my knowledge. And Senator Scott Herndon, Senator Scott Herndon, again from North Idaho, says that he's had public works contractors in his district saying they have to guarantee that they will not segregate multi-use restroom facilities based on gender identity or sexual orientation. And they think that that's they're endorsing allowing a biological man to use a female restroom facility by signing these contracts, I guess. And a lot of times public works contracts tend to be hyper local, they just have local or state funding. And so he's saying he wants to codify the notion that you don't have to consider those things when you're contracting if it's just state and local funding rather than federal. So it's a little bit of a it's kind of an in the weeds type thing, but it's essentially a bathroom bill that is kind of tied up in different things. So it's kind of a hard one to suss out.
Yeah. Okay. Scott, let's talk about Avamore. This is a kind of subdivision, I guess, for lack of a better word, development. Yeah. It is near the city of Eagle, and they are one step closer to annexing this into the city of Eagle. Normally, you would think, well, okay, it's not that big of a deal. This has been controversial ever since Avamore was being developed.
Yeah, most people know what this is. This is that development off of Highway 55 on your way up to McCall or Donnelly. And they are asking to annex into Eagle. And this week they had their first hearing before before Planning and Zoning Commission. And right now there's about 750 houses in there. They've got another 50 under construction. They're limited in Ada County. This was approved by the Ada County Commissioner several years ago for up to 100 or 839 houses. And so to go beyond that, they need to get approval to annex into the city of Eagle. The thing is that it's about 5 miles away from the nearest Eagle city border right now at the corner of Beacon Light Road and Highway 55. And to provide services up there, fire services and police services, sewer, water, would be very, very expensive because it's so far away. And there's some dueling fiscal impact studies on how much it would cost the city of Eagle. And essentially, it would cost the taxpayers of Eagle to subsidize annexing this into city limits. And so they had their first public hearing before planning and zoning. They had to cut off testimony at 10 o'clock so they wouldn't get too tired, which I actually think is a really smart idea. They're going to continue the public hearing later on. So we're probably going to see this for several weeks as they take public testimony. And then if it gets approved by planning and zoning, then it will go before city council for approval. They're talking about as many as 20,000 acres and as many as 10,000 houses, 22,000, 25,000 residents at full build out. It would go into three counties. We include Ada County, Boise County, and Gem County. So it's a pretty massive thing. You know, the city of Eagle right now is 26,000 people. You're talking about almost doubling the size of Eagle, and it's 5 miles away with nothing in between Eagle and Avamore. So it's really a big deal, and I think it's kind of a cautionary tale for the county, Ada County commissioners, to be approving planned communities like this in the middle of the desert when at some point in the future they're going to become begging to a city for public services, and whether that's tenable for a city to do that or not. Is a big, big question mark.
So Scott, I know you said that this was like the first hearing. I mean, it was a fairly packed house, correct? A lot of,
right.
So was it more people for this or against it?
There's a pretty concerted effort against it. And they're citing the fiscal impact that essentially if Eagle annexes this in, it's going to cost Eagle taxpayers. And I think everybody who testified on, was it Tuesday night or Wednesday night? Tuesday night was against it. Now, there are other people signed up and they just didn't have time to get to everybody. So I'm sure there will be people who testify in favor of it. But so far, there's a pretty strong concerted effort to oppose the annexation.
Well, and very quickly, because we do need to wrap up, is that we should, I think it's worth noting too, that then you have, what, some city council members plus the mayor who have been, I don't know if you would say in favor of annexing this, but definitely got some campaign money from from folks involved with Avamore.
Yeah, the developers of Avamore have donated to Mayor Jason Pierce and a couple of city council members who won their elections and are now in public office. And you know, opponents cite that as criticism that they're bought and paid for by the developers. You know, when that gets to city council, we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.